It's interesting because writing on this project began well over a decade ago, and you'll be surprised how it feels like it might have been made just yesterday. Howdy, I'm Jeff Goldsmith, and this is the Q&A. My agenda is simple. Each week, I plan to bring you in-depth insights into the creative process of storytelling. You know, The Last Detail is such a fantastic film. It's a classic. If you've never seen it, you've really got to. And we chat about it a bit today, and that's why it was such an honor to have novelist co-writer Daryl Ponickson and co-writer-director Richard Linklater to chat about their latest film, Last Flag Flying. As a novel, Last Flag Flying began as a direct sequel to The Last Detail, but it evolved into a standalone drama as the film. And as you'll hear, the novel was written soon after we went to war in Iraq, and sadly not much has changed in the years since, so the film is poignant as ever. I gotta say, it was great to hear how these storytellers collaborated on and off for over a decade to create such a heartfelt, character-driven drama, so I know you'll dig this episode. And speaking of things to dig, this episode is sponsored by ScreenCraft. Are you writing a screenplay? The 5th annual ScreenCraft Screenwriting Fellowship is open for applications. The ScreenCraft Fellowship is one of Hollywood's top programs for discovering and launching emerging screenwriters. All of last year's winners signed with industry literary managers, and ScreenCraft offers winners the opportunity to mentor with Academy Award-winning screenwriters and producers, studio executives, agents, and managers. This year's fellowship deadline is March 1st, 2018, and you could enter any and all ScreenCraft writing programs and competitions in 2017 and 2018 with the exclusive 10% discount coupon code QA Podcast. All one word, just enter QA Podcast for the discount. Remember, ScreenCraft is dedicated to helping screenwriters and filmmakers succeed, so please check out screencraft.org for more info. And while you're surfing around online, I hope you'll check out my digital magazine Backstory on the iPad. It is the place to go for amazing television, film, and theater content. Now, folks, one of the cool things I'm able to do in Backstory is something I call post-publishing. That means even after we publish an issue, we could push new articles into it. So if you've purchased issue 29 or a subscriber, just open it up every now and then and check back for updates of new articles as we post-publish them into the magazine. And we still have a few other ones floating in as well, like a great one for Thor Ragnarok that we're not going to release until the film comes out in theaters because we focus so much on some of the film's bigger spoilery sequences that it wouldn't be fair to release it any time before then. Remember, issue 29 of Backstory is our Blade Runner 2049 issue, and I simply can't wait for you to be able to read it. And don't worry, you'll be able to read every single issue of Backstory at www.backstory.net soon, because our servers have been transferred and now we're just in final testing and design, and we're even working on it during weekends now, so stay tuned. Right now, as you know, Backstory is available on iPads as the Backstory app. It's also available on Android tablets via Google Play. Just look for the Backstory app to find us and you have it. Now, not only are there great articles on Blade Runner 2049, but we also covered the original Blade Runner with interviews with Hampton Fancher and David Webb Peoples, so don't miss that. We even had Jason Isaacs, the star of Star Trek Discovery. We have articles on the horror film It. We had Danny McBride and David Gordon Green on TV's Vice Principals, and so much more. So I hope you check it out. And of course, don't forget to check out screencraft.org as well. But now, without any further ado, let's jump right into a posh Beverly Hills hotel room where I got to chat with novelist co-writer Daryl Ponickson and co-writer-director Richard Linklater about their latest film, Last Flag Flying. All right. Well, as we're sitting here with Rick and Daryl, Daryl, starting with you just for a second, you know, The Last Detail, directed by Hal Ashby off of a screenplay by Robert Towne, is a classic. And it was an adaptation of your novel. And I'm just curious, what was something that really, truly surprised you in the movie that you couldn't expect when you first saw it? Something that just kind of was
The ending. The ending was entirely different from the book, and at the time it was upsetting to me. And as a few years passed, I got it. You know, I realized. I said, "Of course, that's the only ending there could be." But you know, the novelist, the first-time novelist, just sees what's missing. You know, and doesn't realize that film is a whole other kind of language.
Did they ever talk to you about it?
I was friends with the producer, so he kind of kept me in the loop. And at one point, they hit a snag, and they had me work on it for 2 weeks, and that got me into the Writers Guild. But I don't think a whole lot of what I did made it to the film. It sounds quaint now, but that film was held up for a long time because of the language.
Yeah, a wee bit quaint. If that was something that surprised you, what was something that you truly missed from your novel, and then we'll get to this film. What was something that you missed that they just weren't able to adapt?
In the first one?
In Last Detail.
Well, it's not that simple. I mean, they took it and did it their way. I think there was an element. I had an element of depth to the character that Nicholson played that they didn't have, and I think that was probably the right choice. And so that's the only thing that comes to mind, really.
As we get to Last Flag Flying, you wrote it in 2005.
2004, I think.
2004,
2005, sorry.
But so when you sat down to kind of plot out a sequel to Last Detail, what were some of the things that were running through your mind, and did you see it as another filmic opportunity? Because obviously Last Detail, by then, had become a classic.
Yeah, it was the invasion of Iraq and the idea of going into another quagmire. When Powell said, if you break it, you own it, I thought, oh, geez, here we go. We're certainly going to break it. And then it was a matter of imagining my three guys all these years later. What would they have to say about the current state of affairs at Quagmire? And that was the impetus. That's what kicked it off.
Rick, when did you first see it?
The novel kind of floated my way. I think it was 2005. And I read it and just loved it. I read it a couple times, started taking notes. I just kind of loved it. I love these characters. And I think I was in a similar headspace of just complete, just aghast at this war we had so marched headlong into. Even though we, unlike Vietnam, we called it in advance. You know, millions of people marched. So many people knew it was a disaster before it even started. And yet they started anyway. And so it's just, you know, there's a certain amount of anger there for every fatality, every Iraqi, you know, citizen who's killed. You know, it was just a disaster, and it was so painful to have seen it coming, and to, it seemed inevitable. It just felt like post 9/11, and I think the book really captured just the paranoia of, oh, everyone's a suspect, and, you know, it was a really crazy time. Our country was... like something bad had happened, and it was all emotions. But the war itself felt like a lynching of some kind. You know, like, okay, something happened, and we're just going to go, someone's got to pay. And so we lynched a country. It's what it felt like to me. But so this captured so much of those mixed feelings. And yet to kind of honor the person who has no power, you know, it's not... from the general's perspective, you know, these are the grunts, you know, these is the people who don't even register a blip. Both in our movie, certainly Larry Shepard Jr.'s death is nothing to them, you know, and nor was Jimmy Hightower's way back in Vietnam. That just another little report on a thing and a medal or something gets shipped off to the family. So they're not big. This wasn't big time events. They weren't at the My Lai massacre. You know what I mean? This is kind of from the grunt trench perspective. So I really appreciated that part. I thought I could really relate to that.
From what I've heard, you started writing a script kind of pretty early, like back in 2006, maybe?
Yeah, well, we started right at that time.
Right. He came.
We jumped right in.
Right after the book was written, and immediately, you know, we started doing a script.
Yeah.
And so what was the atmosphere like? Because, you know, people were starting to kind of do some Iraq movies back then, and they weren't exactly getting the box office they expected.
Yeah, we were the fallout from that atmosphere. That I think it took a while, because you have all these feelings and emotions, but then you realize, oh, this is too fresh. This is too urgent. This is too much of an open wound. I mean, no one would even see the movie. I think it's just... so we were definitely not meant to happen at that time. And I think from this vantage point, it's, you know, this extra decade has been good. You know, I think people can actually see the movie for what it is and not be so wound up in the immediacy of it. Even not that this war ever really ended, but it's definitely people have a... I think you need that decade to have a perspective. You saw the same with Vietnam, like a lot of those some of the better movies were 10 years after, you know.
Strangely, Vietnam actually ended, but we're actually still over in Iraq, so.
Yeah.
And likely always will be.
I think that's what they were going for all along, like the forever war.
Yeah.
The perpetual war for perpetual peace has
out of George Orwell's 1984.
Has happened.
And it doesn't, it's not like everybody in country is affected by that war. I mean, most people in the country are vaguely aware of it. You know, they go about their business, and, 1% of the population are out there actually in the trenches, you know.
Yeah, that disconnect is really disconcerting, and it's not really the public's fault. It's just the way it's set up, mm-hmm. and it's so not healthy because the command gets to treat them like dirt or just, cannon fodder, where if it was really a more smattering across the population, they'd have to be a little more careful. That's what I think, you know. So,
well, you know, one of my fundamental questions in all of that was, and it comes up in the movie, whose life is it worth, finally, that war? Is it worth the president's daughters? You know, is it worth a congressman's son, a senator's son? Because we don't seem to see them dying in these wars.
I agree. I mean, it's something that's always been, you know, questioned from Vietnam forward. So, I mean, the similarities between the two were perfectly equal. And I'm curious, when you were batting it around back in those days, in the early days, was there ever talk of Nicholson becoming involved or any of the original actors from Last Detail and it staying as a true sequel filmically?
Well, right off the bat, I think we were pushing it. I mean, Otis Young wasn't alive.
Of course.
So that's a tough start there. We did throw it around theoretically, but it was really clear that wasn't really a possibility. It never got any traction, and I think that coupled with this Hollywood not really realizing no one wants to see a movie about this subject matter, but we never achieved anything remotely like Liftoff back then. Like, I never had a meeting or with anyone.
You mentioned Otis Young, and just the other night, I was talking to Fishburne, and I said, do you realize why your character is a preacher? He said, no. I said, because Otis Young quit acting and became a preacher before he died.
Interesting.
And so I paid a little homage to him, and he got a kick out of that.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Well, so when you realized that it wasn't going to be filmically a sequel, what did you start doing as writers to kind of distance it, to make it its own thing, to make it something new and different? Was it really just a matter of...
That was the freeing element. Once we realized it wasn't a sequel, and this is 05, 06, you know, early, almost immediately, that's when we really got got going with this idea of like, okay, we're freed from whatever constraints there, and we got to introduce things that I think really helped us in the storytelling process, like adding a lot of the Vietnam background, something really specific with them, even though in the movie it's kind of ambiguous, but clearly they all served in Vietnam together and something happened and, you know, Doc took a fall. It's just bad things happened. So that kind of, you would believe that bond all these years later. It made that much more sense that Doc would look them up because there was perhaps a deeper bond there, and some of our themes it freed us up, I think, enormously. And it was a long process, but we had fun with it. And I remember kept telling Daryl, you know, our time's going to come. This is going to come around. It's the country's, no one's ready for this now, but these characters are too good. And I think this means enough to enough people that our day will come. And it was a great day when it did, when I was able to call Daryl, hey Daryl, guess what? I think it's actually happening.
We didn't realize our day would come on the seventh game of the World Series, but here it is.
Well, so I'm curious, just from a standpoint of craft, what's it like for you two to write together? Were you ever in the same place, or were you going back and forth?
No, it was electronic for the most part. Yeah. But what I found interesting, I haven't even talked to Rick about this, but I know the screenplay format, and I like it in the same way that I like the format of the haiku or the format of a sonnet. But Rick is a narrative writer more, I think. And so I thought it was interesting, since you would think the novelist would be the narrative, but he kind of ignores all that format stuff and free flows.
Yeah. Storytelling, that's all we're doing. Yeah.
I mean, this is the geekiest thing, but I'm guessing you were writing in Final Draft? Or was it Microsoft Word?
I think I was, but he was writing in his notebook, I think.
Yeah, we just in long passages. Oh, no, it was electronic, okay. But back and forth. And
I ask a lot of writing partners this, and it's confusing, and everyone has their own path. How do you keep track of the master draft? When you're getting stuff from Daryl, when Daryl's getting stuff from Rick, how do you guys decide what's staying in the master draft and what's not?
Well, at one point we get through a draft and we number it. I think we have 22.
Oh, wow.
Last time I checked, I think it was draft 22.
Yeah, a lot of back and forth.
He would rewrite me, and I would rewrite him, and then we'd talk on the phone. And
A lot of conversations.
And this was over a period of some time.
Did you use Skype, or was it really just the phone?
No, phone and email.
I didn't meet Rick in person until rehearsals.
Until rehearsals? Okay. Wow.
Isn't that, I almost never say that because I don't think people would believe
us. I know, it's kind of odd.
Wait, Rick, not even to get the book rights, you didn't meet in person?
Again, we had this relationship, but it was
that's fantastic.
Phone. I mean, I don't know. You know, isn't that funny?
I want to talk about your habit for a second because you could also talk about this as a novelist. How important is outlining to your work, both as a novelist and then once you started screenwriting?
Not very. I kind of start just with the notion of what does this character want, you know, and which is not easy because that changes, and maybe he doesn't even know what he wants, and what are the obstacles in the way, and move from there and let it unfold or evolve. Rather than, I'm always afraid if I do a detailed outline, I'm stuck with it, you know. So I just have the flimsiest of outlines. Kind of know where I'm going.
Like a beginning, middle, end type of thing?
Yeah, I hope that I'll be surprised at the end, you know, but I kind of know where I'm going with it.
Rick?
I'm the opposite. On an original screenplay, I usually starts with note cards and just ideas for scenes, and I detail them visually as much as possible, like what happens, what the characters do, all that. And for me, the dialogue is like the last. I mean, I'll have like a funny line or a good joke, anything that's coming to me, but I'm all about the structure, beginning, middle, end. I've never started a screenplay where I didn't know the end.
Even Boyhood?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. I knew.
We've talked about Boyhood before.
I knew the last shot of Boyhood in year one.
Right. Yeah. Okay. I thought, but a lot changed.
Year one or two, the world was going to change, but I knew where it was going to go. I knew the structure. He was going to leave for college, and it would be his first day. Yeah, like.
Sure. When you note cards, some people literally have a set number of note cards that they want per act. Do you have any limitations like that, or just as many as you want?
You can tell where you have the most ideas is where you have the most notes, and you know. But I start there, just really more architecture, story structure. But it's still pretty free-flowing, and the dialogue's like the fun part, but, you know.
Tell me about your writing day. Do you give yourself a page count or a certain amount of hours that you like to write?
More hours than page count.
What do you go for?
It's whatever you can get. Depends on what else is going on in your life. I've been lucky at certain times that my life would allow. I think pre-having a bunch of kids and stuff, you know, like where I could get up early and just work those first 5 hours of a day or something would be really wonderful. Now it's more catch as catch can, which is really frustrating.
So do you find yourself more of a late night writer?
No, I still want to write during the day. I'm a late night person, but I write less at night. I don't
Interesting.
Know. It's weird. Yeah. I'm
Daryl?
I'm the same way. I go to work in the morning like anybody else, but my day is a little shorter. You know, if I start work at 8, I'm done by 1. And I'm pretty tired at that point. And I avoid writing at night because everything sounds better in the witching hour. You know, and you see it in the morning, it's not that great.
that makes sense.
I think you can have ideas. But yeah, I've always kind of marveled that you hear stuff about, Neil Simon, you know, he writes every morning and then plays tennis. It's like, you know, it seems kind of like once you get kind of professional in your approach, it makes all the sense in the world.
The schedule had 32 days. What was the budget?
What were we? A little bit, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15, I think.
Okay.
15, you know.
How much time did you have for rehearsal?
We had just enough. I always say Amazon Studios gave us just enough budget and schedule to not be, you know, behind the eight ball every single day, which so many movies I've done have felt that way. Like the ambition of the film is so much bigger than my budget and schedule. That just makes every day a huge challenge. Where this, we had just enough. We wrapped early. We wrapped on day 30 of a 33-day schedule.
And how much rehearsal?
Just enough. I would have liked more, but, you know, a couple weeks. Okay, just kind of coming and going. Yeah, and it was early because we were working around, you know, these guys are busy. So Cranston had a book tour, so we rehearsed early, and then there was 3 weeks, usually rehearsing right up, and then you start shooting. But I kind of like we got this little break after rehearsal. We had this intensive rehearsal, then we had a nice break, and then we started. We came back, rehearsed some more, and then started. So
was Daryl with you for the rehearsal at all?
Yeah, you came in.
Not for the whole thing.
Yeah, okay. Kind of came
rehearsal's
in.
A time where a script can grow. Were there any tweaks that you needed that you realized once it got up on its feet that were kind of curious?
To me, added it's, a rewrite? It's a lot of little things, but it's nothing major. It's not like in rehearsals I went, oh my God, the second act doesn't work. You know, nothing
big. It's mostly dialogue, you know, and the inner ear is so different from actual conversation. So what sounds good on the page often isn't good when it's spoken. And stuff like that was happening. Where Carell, for instance, would say, you know, I don't think he would say that. And he would say something more ordinary, and he was right. And so we tweaked it that way.
I try not to get... Yeah, it's because words through a person becomes very real. And I've always thought this isn't, you know... Once you're getting close to production, to me, I want it to be believable. I don't want to. That's where I always say I fire the writer. The director in me fires the writer in me. But the truth is that writer's working all the time. But it's little things. Again, if your structure and everything's working in the big picture, it's just I want the actors to feel like they own it and that they. And they were going back to the book. Fishburne would come up, hey, we got to get that line in there about, you know. That plate in your head awesome. Needs a lube job. He said that. I said, "Yeah, that's a great line. It's not in." And so we all were pulling stuff back from the book, which was fun to have that freedom to do. And then I would even in production, it never ended. I'd get a Daryl was back and forth. He'd visit while we were shooting and go back home or whatever. But I'd get an email from him. Hey, you know what about this line? Like, you see these faces? They've already been spited. So what? You know, it's like, oh, that's a great line. And I'd go tell. You know, Sal, day of, and he's like, yeah, put that in there. You know, so it never ends. The writing to me, that tweaking, that stuff, it was ongoing.
The beginning of rehearsal, he said, the guys want to read the book. He said, so he'd send them a copy of the book. I said, I don't know, is that a good idea?
Yeah.
We did send a copy of the book, and that always happens. You
I
know?
Respect the writer. The actors, you know, if they want that for their character, you know, I've done movies that are based on real people. If they want to meet them, they can meet them. If they don't, I respect that. You know, whatever, everyone's got their own process. I want to respect
something
it.
That's a bit of an artistic challenge on this one that you handled beautifully was I would say pacing could have been a problem, but it's not, in which it's a 2-hour talkie. They are sitting down in cars and trains, hotel lobbies, diners. This is a sit-down talkie. It could have been a play. By the way, and a good one. And I'm curious, what were the challenges that you saw, both as a writer and a director, Rick, to keep it moving, but to never feel rushed because you want that real feeling like you're hanging with those guys?
I think that was just inherent in the structure of what we were trying to do, to just make it feel lived in and yet, you know, pace. You know, you don't want to bog down. And, you know, you get another crack at that in editing. You know, like we had extra material on the train and the cars. And it's like, okay, we get it. You don't really find those redundancies until you've filmed them sometimes. And it's like, okay, we could trim that. So, but, you know, we were blessed with this wasn't a one location movie where it would have really felt that way. I've done those before. This is a road movie. So we get this new locations and they're on the go. The whole movie. So that was a blessing and to go with that. But yeah, you're right. It is wall-to-wall dialogue. And yet...
That could be a good thing, and it was.
The backgrounds are changing. There's a certain newness in the air, every new location. And they're all grungy locations. You know, they're all like the motel rooms and bus stations and, you know, trains and cars and rental vehicles and, you know, all that. So, but that was our tone. That was our structure.
Ooh, hey, I'm cutting in really quick to remind you all about my digital magazine Backstory. It's an iPad magazine that focuses on the art and business of storytelling. Currently, we're an iPad-only magazine and also available on Google Play on other tablets. But fear not, we're coming to the web very soon. You could check out www.backstory.net for updates. As I said earlier, our servers have been transferred. We're in final testing and it's all looking really great. wait, so you will finally be able to read Backstory on the web very soon. One important thing to remember about Backstory is that when you subscribe on the web, you'll get access to every single issue we've ever published, so you'll be in the loop on everything. My team has put a lot of work into our new issue number 29, with Blade Runner 2049 cover stories that include in-depth interviews from writers Hampton Fancher and Michael Green on this utterly fantastic marvel of a film. In fact, some of Hampton's article includes explanations of moments and scenes that were scripted, but never shot for Blade Runner 2049, so that's fascinating stuff as well. There's also plenty more stuff from Hampton, Fancher, and David Webb Peoples regarding the original Blade Runner, including script excerpts that you could read that I researched at the Margaret Herrick Academy Library and the Writers Guild Foundation Library as well. In issue 29, you could also read the entire Blacklist screenplay Bare Knuckle, plus an interview with its writer, David Mateo. Issue 29 also features actor-writer Danny McBride and director David Gordon Green chatting about writing season 2 of HBO's darkly hilarious Vice Principals. We also have actor Jason Isaacs chatting about taking the captain's chair in Star Trek Discovery. Actor George Griffith on playing Ray in Twin Peaks, The Return. Directors Dayton Ferris on Battle of the Sexes. Director Andy Muschietti on the horror hit It. Screenwriter Jason Hall on Thank You for Your Service. And we'll even have a story on Thor Ragnarok, which will be updated into the issue when the film comes out into theaters. And so much more to explore. Remember, if you have an iPad or any tablet with Google Play, the app and issue 1 are both still free, and each individual issue costs less than a beer at a hipster bar. So treat yourself. Look, I really appreciate you considering to support my passion project going live soon at www.backstory.net, so thanks for checking it out. And of course, while you're surfing around online, don't forget to stop on over by today's sponsor, screencraft.org, and enter any of their programs or competitions with the 10% discount code QAPODCAST at screencraft.org. But now, let's jump right back into my conversation with Daryl Ponickson and Richard Linklater about their passion project, Last Flag Flying. Speaking of trains and cars, how much of that was blue screen versus really shot with trains and cars?
It's a kind of a combo. The train stuff, we were lucky just to get Amtrak at all. That was a big bureaucratic thing. Took a while. But a lot of that was blue screen.
I mean, it looked really good. And
yeah.
matching the lighting, passing them when you were doing the night drive.
It's hard to do.
That's not easy.
But yeah, we get these runners. Yeah, it's a bit of a thing. But it's still better than shooting on a live action train because they change speed so much. I've shot a lot on trains and
even a car.
You know, if you're chugging along at 70 miles an hour and then you're down to 35 and you start intercutting those, it's like woo. You know,
I want to get to the spoiler section for our podcast listeners. If you have not seen the movie, press pause, go see the movie, come back. You know, something that all writers battle is exposition. And this is a movie that you don't know what happened to his son. You don't know what happened to them in Vietnam. There was a lot of things flying around. Some of it you told us, like what happened with Doc's wife. Some of it you absolutely do not. And I thought it was a very interesting balance because it keeps our interest. So what were some of the rules on exposition, just starting with Daryl and going back to Rick in a second?
I never heard the term come up, exposition or explaining. The attempt was to make it as real as possible. In conversations, people don't tell everything right away. Unless, of course, you live in Southern California, then you know right away. But in conversation, it comes about slowly.
But there's things omitted. I mean, you know, Rick, obviously we never find out. Like, we find out how his son was killed, but we never find out all the things that were going on in Vietnam that they're talking about. We get traces of them. We don't know why Doc went to jail. We get a little bit of it.
I always think I love when movies and stories do that. It's apt because we're talking about military. We're talking about, you know, things that happen on a battlefield. The guys don't talk about it that much. And I think history, you know, you suppress that. You don't want to deal with it. And that's really what the story's about. So they do, you know, we give just enough where clearly something bad happened. And the couple of times Carell's character asserts himself a little bit. It's very subtle. When he goes, oh, you served 2 years? That's not so bad. And you even go, no, it was pretty bad. and then later, when they're kind of, oh, he was going to die anyway, and, you know, you get a sense of what their buddy went through, and he's like, he jumps back to a bigger picture. Did it ever occur to you that, you know, he kind of snaps a little bit.
If we were doing our duty, this wouldn't happen.
Yeah, like this, whatever. So there's this bigger picture thing of
I thought it was
dereliction
fantastic.
Of duty, and it seems like like an old school thing. Like there was a time in movies where you didn't have to explain everything. There were rituals and there were little clues, but you know, the most famous is in Chinatown. Speaking of Nicholson, what did happen in Chinatown? We don't know. Just odd things happen. Relax, Jake. It's Chinatown. You know, it's ominous. It's, you know, so that's good. You know,
error, like the omission that you had actually richens the story rather than telling us what happened. So that was great.
Because it's not literal to them. They perhaps remember things very differently themselves, you know.
So there's a shorthand between them, which makes sense. You know, a big thing in the movie that kind of is a setup and a payoff is at first when there's the revelation that, you know, Doc's son didn't die a hero and that he was killed by an insurgent randomly, you know, with a bullet to the back of the head. They were very angry about it and that the government gave them one story. Mm-hmm. But then there's a change of heart later when Sal really wants to tell their fallen friend's mom what happened. And she interrupts him and says, "Are you the boys that he saved?" And he can't bring himself to do it. And it's interesting because the whole movie, like he's on that path, but has a change of heart. So what do you think it means for those characters?
He's a warrior of truth, you know, his definition of truth, right?
Right.
So who isn't, you know, we all think we're very truthful, but you know, there's a mercy untruth. And I think that, you know, a moral lie or, you know, this is an interesting area, you know, we all live in. So I love that it builds up to that. And we did that very purposefully, you know, that Sal would have a revelation at that moment, just like, oh yeah, maybe that's not the best thing. Truth is a very blunt instrument.
You know? It's a powerful moment, I think, the most powerful moment, because these three guys are accomplices in a sin that can't be redeemed. And at this point, it becomes so ambiguous about the truth versus the lie on a grand level, you know, on a political level. I think the truth is what we need most of all. On a personal level, sometimes the lie is going to comfort you, save you even.
Yeah.
Well, it's a movie that deals with funerals and deals with putting the dead to rest. Rick, one of the most interesting images that I recalled seeing was that on the coffin, there was all these documents strapped to it. You know, there was all these papers and seals. I'd never really seen that in a movie before. Was that something that came up during research, that image?
Well, yeah, you try to get this right. You talk to the people who really do that and say, oh, yeah, no, we have this information. We have, this is the mortuary affairs detail. Here's the papers and it's strapped on. Yeah, you try to get all that right and you realize, oh, they're processing a fallen soldier. You know, that's how it feels and looks. They're in a box and there's these at every stop, there's, you know, oh, the guy from the recruiting office comes over, they put on a uniform and they carry them, you know. It's like, wow, it's a big bureaucratic ceremonial, you know.
Never
ritual.
Seen paperwork on a coffin. I mean, that really gave a weight and reality to it. You know, I know we're starting to run low on time, but I think a good thing to do would be to talk about what was your toughest scene as both a writer and a director. What was the scene that you kept coming back to, and how did you creatively push through to the challenge? So I guess start on the page.
God, do we have a toughest scene?
That's for you to answer.
I don't know. I'm so process oriented.
Okay.
Like some are harder than others, and I notice the ones you keep rehearsing the most. When something's working, like, oh, okay, let's move on to this other thing. And then the ones you just kind of keep grinding through. And I think the ones that we really had to discover was probably something as, you know, like the bar scene in New York when they're having that, he was going to die anyway. And, you know, that's something we spent a lot of time on. Because what's the nuance there? To what degree are they going to come out and talk about it? And, like, do you get this way every time you drink? Yeah, pretty much. You should, you know, he's Sal setting things up with the family up in Boston, and, you know, there's a lot going on in these scenes, but it's getting those notes right to fit into your story. Sometimes that comes a little late in the process because you're still figuring things out. But that's not a very dramatic. I wish I could say, oh,
it's okay.
When the colonel, you know, but that's some of the bigger scenes are working from the book, the script, and the first rehearsal. You know, some of these are just meant to be. Other ones require a lot more massaging. But I think it's in the area of storytelling where you haven't fully decided what the characters know and don't know, and maybe you have to feel your way through spend a lot of time together and feel your way through it before you can fully answer some of these questions.
Would you say it was the same as a director? Would it be that same kind of scene that was logistically a challenge for you, or is there something else as a director? And then we'll get to Daryl.
Yeah, I don't know. This film was so frictionless. I didn't have any trouble.
That's beautiful.
Movie's hard to make, and every movie to me is the same, too easy to make. So I never remember.
Great.
We're so prepared. So I don't know what to say.
Daryl, for your toughest scene, it could be on the page when you're writing the novel, or it could be when you were adapting the script.
I think the scene that seems to resonate with me, and it's not like it was difficult, it just that now that it's done and shot and I see it, it comes as a surprise, is the very brief discussion about pain. You know, if they wanted us to have that stuff, they would have issued it. And he says, "Well, they did kind of."
In the way they did.
And they talk about pain, and Mueller says, "Not that kind of pain." And Lacranston says, "Pain is pain," and it really resonates now because of the whole opiate hysteria we're going through, and really facing as a country. Not only physical pain and what we do about it, but psychic pain. So it's a scene now that I can't get out of my head, you know. Mm-hmm.
Well, Daryl, Rick, you guys have been very generous with your time. I can't wait to see what you do next. Congrats on a great film. Thanks for sitting down to chat.
Right. Yeah, well, nice talking to you.
And that's how the Q&A went down. Special thanks again to novelist co-writer Daryl Ponickson and co-writer director Richard Linklater for spending time chatting about their latest film, Last Flag Flying. Of course, also special thanks to our sponsor, screencraft.org. Don't forget you could use exclusive coupon code QAPODCAST to save 10% off any of their programs or competitions in 2017 or 2018. So head on over to screencraft.org and check it out. The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith is a copyright of Unlikely Films Incorporated in 2017. All rights reserved. And folks, I gotta thank you again for spreading the word about issue 29, our Blade Runner 2049 issue. And of course, get ready to read the entire magazine soon at backstory.net. And hey, if you'd like to show your support and donate to this free podcast so I can continue to buy new equipment and use these funds to pay for all my podcast hosting fees, feel free to send a PayPal virtual tip to yogoldsmith@gmail.com. Any amount is greatly appreciated. As for your social networking needs, you could follow Yo Goldsmith on Twitter or could check out my Facebook fan page. I'm Jeff Goldsmith, the publisher of Backstory and the host of the Q&A, thanking you for tuning in and telling you to stay out of trouble. Till next week.